Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 4. Hiranyakashipu terrorizes the universe. Text 13. Tamangamattam madunodugandhina. Vivrittatam raksham ashesha dishnapa. Upashato payana pani bhirvina. Shibhistapo yoga balauja samparam. Translation. Oh, my dear king, Hiranyakashipu was always drunk on strong-smelling wines and liquors, and therefore his coppery eyes were always rolling. Nonetheless, because he had powerfully executed great austerities in mystic yoga, although he was abominable, all but the three principal demigods, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu, personally worshipped him to please him by bringing him various presentations with their own hands. Purport. In the Skanda Purana, there is this description. Upayanam dadu sarve vina devan hiranyakshaha. Hiranyaka. Hiranyakashipu was so powerful that everyone but the three principal demigods, namely Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu, engaged in his service. Madhvacharya says, Aditya Vasavo Rudras Trividahi Surayata. There are three kinds of demigods, the Adityas, the Vasus, and the Rudras, beneath whom are the other demigods, like the Maruts and Sadhyas. Marutas Chaiva Vishvecha Sadhyaschaiva Chatadgata. Therefore, all the demigods are called Tri Pishtapa, and the same word Tri applies to Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and Lord Vishnu. You are getting insight into the scope of Hiranyakashipu's terrorism, and also insight into his own personal lifestyle. You're hearing that he ruled the three worlds, Triloka, as well as Tripishtapa. He got up to the level of demigods except for the top, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, Lord Vishnu. The other layers of demigods under the Gunavatars were all subservient to Hiranyakashipu. With our tiny brains, it's hard for us to conceive how someone could rule all the three worlds, because these days, if someone can just minimally manage one city, such a person is considered a great Mahatma. What to speak of manage a nation, and what to speak of manage just the Earth planet? How is it possible? Could it truly be for real that Hiranyakashipu could control the whole universe? Yes, through the power of mystic yoga, tapa yoga. By austerity, you can develop mystic powers to the extent that you can do these things. Today's tiny, puny human beings have no understanding of any austerity other than to study very hard and pass the exams and go to a top school to study very hard in school and then go through the austerity of groveling before a prospective employer. Srila Prabhupada described the austerity in this way. He said, you go to your employer like a little dog and you move your tail back and forth. And you promise, I will satisfy you. That is austerity. But what is it in comparison to the austerities of Hiranyakashipu? Yet, the austerities of today's puny human beings and the austerities of Hiranyakashipu are similar in that the goal is the same, to enjoy the senses. Whether you control just your one-bedroom flat or you control the whole universe, still, the goal of a materialistic controller is the same. Everything depends on power. And Hiranyakashipu understood that real power comes from austerity. And his austerities were unmatched. They were so severe that the demigods appealed to Lord Brahma, please, do something, give him what he wants. Lord Brahma warned Hiranyakashipu, I'm going to give you benedictions, but benedictions are often very difficult to cope with. In other words, don't think that just because you're going to extract various benedictions out of me that automatically your life is going to be successful. No. Material benedictions require, they're demanding to maintain. You might think, well, if I had Hiranyakashipu's benedictions, if I ruled all the worlds, what would be the problem? Life would be easy. Remember Kamsa's commissioning Akrura to go to Vrindavan? And Kamsa explained his strategy and then concluded that once all the obstructions are clear, put my father in jail, get rid of all the yadus, it will be very pleasant to rule the world without any interference. This is Asura Bhava. And we have to watch that we don't have these tendencies coming out of us as devotees of the Lord. It will be very pleasant to control everything without any interference. Lord Brahma warned Hiranyakashipu, it's not exactly like that. Anytime you try to do something in this world that's not directly for Krishna's pleasure, there's always something antagonistic, irritating, burdening. What does Prahlad Maharaj say, the son of Hiranyakashipu? He says that you want to figure out where the distress in your life begins? You want to figure out where all the problems in your life have begun? Not simply in the acting for sense gratification and material gain, but in the plan-making stage, before you act, that's where the distress begins. This is how lethal the material atmosphere is. Your suffering begins in the plan-making stage. Lord Brahma was being very truthful by warning Hiranyakashipu in a subtle way. Nevertheless, it was a warning. Life in the jagat, life in the material universe is not what it seems to be. That's always the case. It's not what it seems to be. Even you get so much power, so much opulence, you'll have difficulty. Therefore, Durga, her very name lets you know what's going on within her domain. It'll be very difficult to make progress, Durga. Yet, under the spell of the loose energy, our heads fill with plans. how we're going to be successful, how we're going to be happy and peaceful and satisfied. Does material power and opulence automatically translate into happiness, satisfaction? That will be the story of this Hiranyakashipu. I think I've explained some years ago, giving you true stories of persons who have won lotteries in the USA. $300 million. And they kill themselves later because they can't cope with all the pressure of having so much money and so many people coming to them asking for money. When we look at Maya without knowledge, we think, oh, if I won $300 million, all my problems would be solved. I'd have the best of everything. But some of these sweepstakes, these lottery winners, they would publicly say, I curse the day that I won this money. Once again, Lord Brahma tells Hiranyakashipu, these benedictions will be difficult to deal with, but you can have them. Quite a few cases are like that, where persons win lotteries, the highest lotteries, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they just totally regret such a thing ever happening. Their life becomes turned upside down. Now, the lesson we can learn from Hiranyakashipu is that no matter how much comfort and opulence you arrange for yourself, you won't be satisfied. Please let Hiranyakashipu's lifestyle convey this point very deep into our heads and hearts. Because within this material world, there's always that contamination in which we think, if I can just arrange things and adjust things and achieve things, I'll be satisfied. Let's consider Hiranyakashipu's lifestyle. Shukadeva Goswami describes that lifestyle as ekarad vishayan priyan. He was Ekarat, the one controller of the universe. Vishayan Priyan. He had sense gratification that was dear to him. Just think about that. Not only sense gratification, but sense gratification that's especially dear to you. How can it get any better than that? And not only sense gratification that was Priya, very dear to him, but as much as he liked. Everyone was under his control, and still, although possessing all these achievements, he's not satisfied. Srila Prabhupada asks us to consider this point in our analysis of current society. Let's look at Hiranyakashipu's personal lifestyle. Tamanga mattam madunoru gandina. Vivritta tam raksham ashesha dishna pa. The description of his habits and his behavior would thrill the hearts and minds of Age of Kali residents today. Always drunk on strong-smelling wines and liquors. And therefore his coppery eyes were always rolling. This is considered to be an exalted state today. perhaps just now in India, such things are not being openly advocated amongst the leaders, the intellectuals, the politicians, scholars, so on and so forth. But that day will come soon. In the Western world, these symptoms are considered to be as of the nectar of devotion. Yes, it is a fact. Your guests here from Australia, Gopur Vrindesh and Nanda Mandir, they can tell you that this description of Aranyakashipu would be so cherished by the average Australian, the average British person, the average American. Maybe not every day, but certainly on weekends. This is where materialistic society leads you. And I have to spend a lot of time explaining this to overseas Indian students, that you don't get one without the other. You don't get materialistic goals without the materialistic lifestyle. Because they have it in their minds that, because we're Indians, we'll live material life, but we will not become degraded like the Australians or the British. I have to explain them. It doesn't work like that. Once you take shelter of a particular mode of nature, that mode of nature invades your consciousness, envelops your consciousness. It becomes you, so to speak. You become it. You become Rajagun, Tamagun, because you've let those modes into your mind and heart. That's why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Karnam Guna Sangasa, Sarasad Yoni Janmasu. The culprit is material nature, and you are associating with material nature. Therefore, things are going to happen. You'll be polluted. You'll be dragged down. So the overseas Indian students, they don't openly discuss the Hiranyakashipu lifestyle. But if you question them, they'll admit, I have tried it, and if I haven't tried it, I secretly long to try it. There's something alluring about the mode of passion and ignorance. You can be the enjoyer, and then you can become intoxicated and forget all your anxieties. You can feel like you're on top of the world and be so merry. What is the term the Westerners use for this state? They, with great delight, refer to it as being wasted. With great happiness, they announce, what am I going to do this weekend? I'm getting wasted. And then their hair stand on end just anticipating the coming weekend. This is the best that materialistic society can offer you. And materialistic society cannot go on without intoxication. Therefore, if you're going to embrace materialistic goals, you should know you're also embracing intoxication. Because the stress that comes upon you from pursuing materialistic goals will be so great, you must take intoxication to cope with it. Just like now at the call centers in Bangalore, the stress is just knocking over these young people working there like a tsunami. Every call center now has to hire psychologists in order to care for the staff. Because the young people working at the call centers, they're getting such abuse from overseas callers. You know, the overseas person thinks, I need some help with my Hewlett-Packard printer, or I need some help with my Dell computer. Okay, dial a toll-free number. Wait, but this person doesn't sound like he's Australian or American or British. Who are you? They say, what is your name? And then the person from Bangalore will always give like an English name.
My name is Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, huh? Where are you from? Where is this call being referred to?
Oh.
And they have to be truthful.
Oh, we're in Bangalore, India.
India! Why are all our jobs going to India? You people. Also, often, you know, foul language. You people, taking our jobs, ruining our economy. You people. The pressure is so great that these young people are cracking up. They are not accustomed to the full brunt of materialistic goals. They're thinking, oh, you've got money over in your country. We're getting money over here. What's the problem? Let there be world peace. They don't understand what the result of material ambition is. It's hitting them right in the face. Please understand this point. That you can't have one thing without the other. The way society is constructed now is that there'll be so much stress as you pursue your materialistic goals, and then you have to turn to intoxication. Things have become easier from the materialistic point of view, you might say, for overseas Indians in Australia now. The word is out that they have certain pubs specializing for the overseas Indians in which they serve kingfisher. Relief has come from the motherland. So please understand that the Hiranyakashipu lifestyle, always drunk on strong-smelling wines and liquors, coppery eyes always rolling, this is Western civilization. This is all it can offer you. And if you buy into its goals, you'll be driven down this path. All right, you may escape, but your children won't. I tell a story at our seminars, weekend gatherings that we do for overseas Indian students, organized by Nityananda Priya in Melbourne and Radha Krishna Chandra in Sydney. Get like 60, 70, 80 students and young professionals, overseas Indians. And for the whole weekend, we present to them the realities. I explained to them how I was doing a program in Canberra. And at the home of one Indian gentleman. And he told me with astonishment, you know what my daughter, my 8-year-old daughter, told me today when she came home from school. She said, Father, when are you and Mother going to live in different houses so I can spend one night in your house and one night in her house? Oh, my school friends are living like that. When are you going to do it? Why are you and Mommy? Why are Mommy and Daddy still in the same house? What's wrong with you? Daddy, please, you have your house. Let Mommy have her house, and I can rotate back and forth like all my school friends. the little girl was feeling like she was some kind of freak or something, that she had two parents in the same, at home. This is the reality. Let us further discuss this point about how intoxication is a must for a material society. There have been times in the history of some Western countries in which they banned the sale of alcohol. Now that's considered to have been a horrible mistake. They claim that by banning the alcohol, they made it even more attractive. And also, the government became corrupted because the police were being paid off to allow illegal alcohol sales to go on. The alcohol that was illegally manufactured was even more potent than before because the criminals manufacturing the alcohol wanted to increase their profits by making super powerful alcohol. This is what they say, that the whole thing turned out to be a very bad mistake. We would say that it depends how serious your government is on helping people and uplifting people. If the government is serious about stopping intoxication, it can be done. And we also say that it's not that you can just say no. This is a big joke in the USA. One president's wife thought that she would do good to all the teenagers in the USA who are engaging in illicit affairs as young people. So she went on a campaign about drugs, about illicit lust affairs. The name of the campaign was Just Say No. Of course, all the teenagers, they just laughed, Just Say No. She was passing out buttons and banners, Just Say No. And so the teenagers and the young people, they made their own banners and buttons, Just Say Yes. In other words, they're saying, how can you take this pleasure away from us of intoxication and illicit affairs? You made your society with 100% material goals, and we're following through from a young age. What's the problem? As Krishna conscious devotees, we're not simply saying no. We're giving better pleasure. Therefore, we have a right to say no intoxication, no illicit affairs, because better pleasure is available. If we were not supplying better pleasure, then perhaps there could be some criticism. You're being very repressive, totalitarian, denying the needed happiness of human beings. But because Lord Chaitanya is giving better pleasure, there can't be any criticism. Let us look at the situation another way. According to the predominant model of society, which is now in the world called free market democracies, the essential principle, which will show up to varying degrees in various societies, is that if there is a mutually beneficial exchange of products, of services, money, it will be very foolish for you to try to declare that exchange illegal. Because the power, the selfish motivation will always triumph. Take the case of banning alcohol. Because I want to forget my troubles and you want money. If I give you money, and you give me something that will help me forget my troubles. That's a mutually beneficial exchange. And so mundane philosophers, social philosophers, economists say, there's nothing you can do to get in the way of that. And you'll be foolish to do it. Because self-interest is so powerful on both sides, not just one side. So they apply this philosophy to cigarettes, alcohol, drugs, abortions, anything where one person wants something and the other person can supply it. Therefore, they're in agreement. It's known as a mutually beneficial exchange. You want my money, and I want your product. I want your cigarettes. I want your abortions. I want your drugs. So I'm giving you my money, and you're giving me the service. Why should a society interfere with that? Now, there are various levels of disagreeing with this point, but they're just fine print. At best, most of the time, social leaders will say that, all right, cigarettes are bad for you. We're not going to ban them. We'll simply make it so if you want to buy cigarettes, the government gets a big profit out of it because it's not good for you. It makes sense, does it? Because alcohol can be destructive, we're not just going to allow random free alcohol sales. No, there has to be a big tax on the alcohol to pay for the lifestyle of your government leaders who are drunk most of the time. It all makes sense, doesn't it? So there's simply various shades of disagreement about this point upon which basically most agree that never totally interfere with a mutual beneficial exchange. This is a cornerstone of Western social philosophy. If you try to do that, you're just wasting your time. People will go around it one way or another, just like when they tried to ban alcohol sales. Organized crime took over and then polluted the government as if the government wasn't polluted before. But there are examples in this world where governments are very strict and everyone knows it. And they adhere to the strict guidelines. Like, for example, in Singapore, everyone knows if you try to traffic in drugs, you can be executed if you're caught. You will be executed if you're caught. So many Western societies criticize this law. Like, how could you be so inhumane as to execute drug dealers? Underneath their protest is this attitude that, although it's very bad to become an addict, it's very bad to ruin your life with drugs, but people want this. And it is a mutually beneficial exchange in that you give me drugs, I give you the money. You want the money, I want the drugs. So you can't execute people when there is a mutually beneficial exchange which rewards everyone's selfish desires. That's what's going on underneath, the unstated reality. Recently there was a case where one Australian citizen was transiting the Singapore airport. He hadn't legally entered into Singapore completely. He was transiting, flying from Vietnam to Australia, and he had so much heroin strapped to his waist under his shirt. So he was waiting for his connecting flight, and he fell asleep in the transit lounge. And then suddenly, he woke up, I'm about to miss my flight. He ran to the gate to board the flight. And in Singapore, they have you have to go through a security check, metal detector before boarding each plane. There's one at every gate rather than like here in Mumbai. You go through one security check, everyone goes to it, and then you go to your gate. No, there they have one before every gate. So he's running, got to make my plane. And he went through the metal detector. And he forgot to take off his belt, his metal belt. Normally he would do that. But he forgot. He was sleeping and in a rush, and the metal detector caught his belt. And so they just came and, okay, let's see. You know, they patted him. What is this? Lifted up his shirt. Oh. So although he was a transit person, still, from the overall point of view, he's within Singapore. And they told him, you know our laws here. You are caught red-handed. You're going to die. Oh, the Australian government protested. It was a whole national uproar. This young boy, 22 years old, how can you kill him just because he's smuggling heroin? How can you be so barbaric to take his life for this? And the Singaporeans replied that everyone knows our laws. We have it all over the airport. On the airplane, when you land, you're told, don't traffic in drugs. There's a death penalty. Everyone knows this. So many diplomatic overtures were made and condemnations of Singapore. And you could see a picture of the boy's mother. She was just like 42 years old. One day her hair was completely black. Within 2 weeks her hair was completely white because of anxiety. So the Australian Prime Minister was saying, how can you bring such pain to this Australian family? Putting them through such a trauma of executing their young boy. And what was the Singaporean government's reply? We are not simply thinking about his pain and the pain of his immediate family. We are thinking of the potential pain of thousands of Singaporeans whose lives have been ruined if they bought his drugs. That point didn't register on the Australians. Why are you executing a drug dealer? Implicit in their protest, which they won't say, of course, is that Western life means everyone is always drugged up and stoned and wasted. All right, some drugs are more dangerous than others. But still, everyone needs intoxication to get through life. So why are you going to execute this purveyor of stronger forms of intoxication, which are not very socially acceptable like other forms of intoxication? That's how they do it. They discriminate between the softer pleasure drugs and the hard drugs. In the end, of course, the boy was executed. They hung him. The hangman was from, he was Singaporean, but from South India. So the hangman was explaining to the newspapers, don't worry, I can make the noose around his neck so that he goes out like that. And the South Indian Singaporean hangman was worried. He said, I've heard rumors they want to give my job to some young guys. I warn you, don't let that happen. They won't put the noose around his neck properly. He'll end up flapping about like a chicken. But he give the job to me, he'll go cleanly. I promise you. This is the reality. So he was executed, and in the state in Australia, where he's from, Queensland, they had a moment of silence for the whole state at the moment he was executed. Some people were rightfully complaining that people are dying at every moment. We don't have a moment of silence for them. Why are we having a moment of silence for a 100% obviously guilty drug distributor? We're having a moment. Think about it. They were saying, think, this doesn't make any sense. People are always dying. No moments of silence. Yet, when this drug dealer was executed, the whole state, for 1 minute, became quiet. Millions of people. This is Kali Yuga. My point is, you buy into the Western goals, and this is what you'll get as a result. You can't separate one from the other. So I have to spend so much time explaining to overseas Indian students and graduates, young professionals, because they have it in their mind, we're going to do it the Indian way. We'll have all the material greed and ambition and none of the social problems. They're like, oh, these Australians, these British, they don't know how to live life. We'll show them. We'll show them how to be degraded with no ill effects. It's a pride, you know? Somehow or other, by Krishna's mercy, I'm able to pull this out of them. They actually come out and say it. Those Australians. Those Aussies. We'll show them. No, you can't have one without the other. You're going to try to endeavor in a high-stress society. You must turn to intoxication. And it's already happening. One devotee, Krishna Katha, and his brother Bhagavat Katha in Melbourne, Australia. They're Marwaris from Calcutta, but they're having a big successful travel agency in Melbourne. And so it's their clientele is 99.9% overseas Indians. And so they were telling me how man and woman comes into their travel agency. And introduce themselves. Not, this is my wife, but this is my partner. and so the devotee will just say very gently, you know, just, oh, your wife. No, not my wife, my partner. This is the language that is used overseas because people don't get married anymore. Just man and woman come together like a business deal and if there's some disagreement, they separate. So why should there be marriage? So they're saying like that. My partner. More and more it's happening. We'd like to get people to think very clearly about the results of their activities. As Srila Prabhupada in this section of the Bhagavatam is asking you to think. Hiranyakashipu had it all, and still he's dissatisfied. How is that possible? Let that lesson sink deep into your consciousness. Because somehow or other, there is this contamination lurking within us that somehow or other, I'm going to enjoy and I'll be all right. I will become fulfilled. I'll achieve my goals. I'll be happy and pass happiness to my family and friends. Think about Hiranyakashipu. He had everything. Yet he was dissatisfied. This is the inherent situation of material life. What about the mutually beneficial exchange, which is a foundational principle in Western social organization? As followers of Bhagavad Dharma, we don't see how either person benefits from the exchange. But as long as you think that perfection means to make so much money, you're going to look at the most dangerous things in this way. You want benefit. You want my product. Never mind that my product is dangerous for you because you want it. And it seems to give you pleasure. Therefore, to some degree, I have a right to sell you it because I want your money. And if it's really bad, well, then let the government make a high tax on it, but let the business go on. That's as best as current social understanding gets. There is no way you can resist this avalanche of degradation. I spent hours, days, trying to convince overseas Indian students and young professionals of this point because they all think they're going to escape. yet they see examples around them all the time where you cannot escape. This is the power of Maya. It's not that we are against intoxication completely. We have the best form of intoxication. Lord Balaram becomes intoxicated, but he has no material body. His pleasure is non-material, is all Satchidananda. When Lord Balaram becomes intoxicated drinking Varuni, it doesn't cause tamagun, doesn't cause rajagun. There's no forgetfulness of his identity in the material sense. Therefore, in Braj Leela, we glorify Lord Balaram's going to Vrindavan and getting intoxicated and dancing with his gopis. We glorify that because we can clearly see the difference between material activity and spiritual activity. An ordinary person will accuse, you're down on intoxication, but then look at Balaram. He's getting intoxicated. Whatever Lord Balaram does simply increases his knowledge and bliss. And what you do in your material activities causes ignorance, misery. Instead of Satchidananda, you get Asat, Achit, and Nirananda. We have to see the difference all the time between the varieties of the spiritual world and the varieties of the material world. Why was Lord Balaram going to Vrindavan in the first place? That question has to be meditated upon by the Krishna Bhaktas. How could Lord Balaram leave Dwarka and go to Vrindavan? Now you might say, well, he was so overwhelmed by separation from Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda Mai, the cowherd boys and the cowherd girls. That is true, but still, the full understanding of Balaram's trip to Vrindavan is not there in just that aspect. You have to remember, Krishna is there with him in Dwarka. How can Balaram tear himself away from Krishna? Furthermore, why didn't Krishna go? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, this is the first question you have to ask. Premarnava, the ocean of Prem, why didn't he go to Braj? He says the answer is that the Dwarkavasis wouldn't never let Krishna go, knowing how loving Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda Mai are, how loving the cowherd boys and cowherd girls are, knowing that they'll never would let Krishna go. They let Balaram go. But still the question is, how did Balaram tear himself away from Krishna in order to go to Vrindavan? Such a thing is amazing, inconceivable. The answer is, Balaram was overwhelmed and bewildered by his attachment for the residents of Vrindavan, and so that even though he couldn't tear himself away from Krishna, bewildered by separation from the Vrijvasis, he did go. And there he experienced transcendental intoxication from the Varuni beverage, which was sent by Varuna as service. So this is as close as we come to intoxication. We relish Lord Balaram's intoxicated state in Vrindavan, his challenging of the Jamuna River. Come here. I want to play in your waters with my girlfriends. And you know how the Jamuna River dismissed him. You're drunk. I don't have to listen to what you say. A A few minutes later, the Jamuna River is begging for mercy. I forgot who you are. Please forgive me. Listening to this, Leela, we get pleasure and enlightenment that no state of intoxication known to mundane man can ever produce. So there are always going to be two different worlds, the devotee and the non-devotee. You can't wash over that point. The devotee has his sights on the world of unlimited spiritual variety. And a non-devotee today is forced by the oppressive modes of passion and ignorance to simply have the goal of making money, becoming stressed, and then becoming intoxicated to forget the stress. That's all that's going on. Mm-hmm. Let us remember Lord Brahma's warning to Hiranyakashipu. I'm going to give you the benedictions, but they're going to be difficult to maintain. And let us remember how Hiranyakashipu, in spite of being Ekarat, the one ruler of the universe, and having all his most dear forms of sense gratification, whenever he liked, as much as he liked, he was unsatisfied. Why? Because he can't control his senses. Real wealth means to control your mind and senses. Without that, no matter how much you have, even the whole universe, you'll be unsatisfied. This is our point. And you'll see how the events of the world bring this point out more and more. We'll stop here and ask if you have any questions. Yes.
Thank you very much, Maharaj, for a nice class. Maharaj, I have a very practical problem. Is that those devotees who accept household life and he has to follow the regulatory principles and maintain the ashram in the true sense, and always he has a strong desire that once his target time of grahastha life gets over, then he would like to accept vanprastha life. So after some point of time, he always thinks it that, let me just accept the vanprastha life and completely commit myself in Krishna consciousness. Now, for that, he has to plan himself very properly as far as material things are concerned. Unless until he doesn't plan it, he will not be following his responsibility thoroughly. So if a devotee who wants to plan himself, he has to work harder to make his saving properly, so that the right time he can get out from his household activities of earning money and going in this material world. So as you said very clearly, you work hard, that means you get attracted to material life, and then your consciousness becomes degraded. And once it's got degraded, that consciousness of completely committing into the vanprastha life and committing 100% to Krishna consciousness becomes loose. So in that circumstances, a grahastha, how should he manage in such a way that he can, at the right time, he can get out also, at the same time he doesn't get contaminated with the outside world? Because as you said very clearly, more you get attracted to material life, more it will be harder for you to get out from it.
Wanting to take vanaprastha near the end of your life is not a material goal. At the same time, how do you know that you will live a full life? Just like now, in Mumbai, the age for heart attacks amongst the young executives, is dropping lower and lower. Before, it used to be in the 40s, businessmen would have heart attacks. Then in their 30s, now it's down to the 20s. So how do you know you're going to live a full life? At the same time, no doubt, as a householder, you have to plan like you're going to live a full life, even though there's a chance you won't. There has to be the proper balance between dealing with today and dealing with tomorrow. If you just destroy your spiritual life endeavoring so hard in order so that in the future you'll be able to serve Krishna more, that shows that you haven't taken proper advantage of your counselor. There has to be the proper blend between today and the future. Here's one way that I've found in advising devotees that always keeps the balance. If you make as your number one priority every day to daily try to hear with attention the chanting of Hare Krishna, that will keep you on track through dealing with the present as well as dealing with the future. Another example, so often I'm in Australia, I meet overseas Indians who say, I want to chant Hare Krishna now, but you have to understand, I'm going to school and working at the same time. It's not possible for me to chant 16 rounds. Impossible. But 3 years from now, when I finish school and I finish the working at the same time as going to school, then I can start chanting Hare Krishna. So I always explain, this is an extraordinary mistake. You don't know. It's like our Nanda Mandir. He was doing his BS in IT at the same time he was driving a taxi. So this is a big workload and big study load. I explain, never delay the chanting of Hare Krishna for anything. If you keep that principle in mind, then you'll be able to prioritize properly. Not only do you want to chant Hare Krishna, but you want to chant Hare Krishna with attention. Make that your number one priority. Don't put that off into the future. In order to chant Hare Krishna every day with attention, you've got to organize your lifestyle to give the Hare Krishna mantra the pride of place, the topmost position in your daily schedule, so you can concentrate. So automatically, that will pull the rest of your life together. Yes, no doubt householders have to plan for the future. But you can't destroy your present hoping for the better future. So if you keep the Hare Krishna mantra and its attentive chanting as your number one daily goal now, that'll keep you from going off the deep end too much into planning for the glorious future while neglecting the present that you have. This daily regimen of chanting the holy name with attention pulls the rest of your life together. Because if you're serious about chanting with attention, you've got to organize your day properly. Take that away. Take the attentive chanting of the holy name away, and yes, life is bewildering and overpowering for everyone. But add that there. And then you're constantly thinking, how much time do I have in the day? My first priority is I must chant with attention. Let me organize everything around that, whether I'm studying, working, so on and so forth. Automatically, that gets your whole all aspects of your life together. And you can properly discriminate between future planning and dealing with the present. That is my answer.
Maharaj, second point which I always have a problem is, as you said, that in our in Bombay also the westernization has increased so much. But now the recent analysis has shown that out of 5 marriages that is taking place in Bombay, 2 marriages are going for a divorce. So 40% cases of divorce is also started in Bombay. Now, the westernization is increasing so much, and we have to go out and work with those people. Sometimes, although we keep concentrated Krishna conscious life, we keep fixed up devotional services, keep it completely focused in chanting, still sometime in our life, a stage of fatigue or a tiredness comes. We get really tired because every day we are battling. It starts from the morning itself, from the newspaper itself it starts, and full day we have to battle with Maya and counteracting it. And sometimes a stage of fatigueness comes up and we wanted to take some rest. Let me just forget everything. And you little bit you do have fatigue nature, Maya traps you. And you get completely bewildered. And then we feel that there is no chance Maya is giving me for little bit rest also. And little bit rest we take it and Maya traps you. And your spiritual life is disturbed. Next day Japa is disturbed. Your attention is disturbed. And it becomes little bit lots of time to completely come back on the same level what it was before. So in that circumstances when little bit fatigue has come in our heart, how to cope up with it and maintain the Krishna conscious standard forever in the same proportion.
First of all, there will, sometime in the future, there'll come a time when the divorce rate in Mumbai will go down, or at least remain stable, just like it has in the West, the divorce rate is going down or becoming stable. Why? Why? Because no one's getting married. So you have that to look forward to in the future. About the fatigue. Yes, there's no doubt that to work and maintain a family is difficult. That's why Shukadeva Goswami predicts in the 12th canto of Bhagavatam, Daksham Katumba Varanam. In the age of Kali, if a man can just maintain one wife and two children, he's known as Daksha. Super expert. That's how difficult it is. First of all, at least the men, before they marry, they should know what they're getting into. They need the instruction and guidance of senior householders to explain what they're getting into. They should have some full awareness of it, so they're not caught by surprise. They should know they're going to have to work, and what is the pressure of working and commuting? They should know about that. And they should understand that they'll have to provide for the desires of the family. Recently, the United Nations has done a study that costs $15 million. They're analyzing why are there so many marriage problems around the world? Why so much divorce? And their conclusion was that each marriage partner has too high expectations, and that's the number one cause of marriage dissolution. They're dreaming that their high expectations will be fulfilled. I was talking to one, my godbrother. He and his wife, they have been married 27 years. And they give counsel to other younger couples. So I was saying to him, I told him about the UN study. And he said, why did they have to spend $15 million for that study? They could have given us the $15 million. We could have just told them straight out what the conclusion is. Too high expectations. You have to know what you're getting into. And then once you get into that, if that is your choice, be prepared to live according to Dharma. And at least you know that the struggle, the fatigue, the hard work is leading to your purification. If you live a life according to Dharma, it is leading to your purification. That part shouldn't be forgotten. By going through that ashram properly, you'll become purified. One way or another, we choose to be purified. All the ashramas are for purification, whether brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas. Each of those four is for purification. So you choose how you want to be purified. As I was explaining to a group of young men that were gathered a couple of weeks ago, many of whom were trying to understand which way should we go. Should we consider brahmachari life, or should we go to grihastha life? And so I was explaining the realities. One way or another, you have to embrace purification. And one way or another, you're going to commute. Now choose your type of commuting. Either you spend 2 hours commuting in Mumbai traffic to your job, or you commute from the ashram to the temple room. Still, choose your type of commuting. Analyze the benefits. Analyze the drawbacks. But you must choose purification. And in the purification, there must be commuting. The brahmacharis are also commuting. As I'm coming up the stairs in the morning, I see them. They're in the hallways and getting ready to go to the morning program and preparing to commute into the temple room. That's a trip. That's a journey. Let us not underestimate or minimize this. It's just that their journey is shorter. You have to see it in that way. It is an honorable thing to maintain a Krishna conscious family. And to commute, to go to work, to support that family. And it is also an honorable thing to live in the brahmachari ashram and to commute to the temple room. Now choose your type of honor. Choose your type of purification. Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, you mentioned two types of intoxications, hard and soft. So, hard intoxicants, it's very easy to convince. But some people come and say that I take only one peg of drinks in the night, helps me to sleep better. Or maybe a little bit of intoxication to overcome stress. So how can we convince these kind of people that...
Oh, you're even here, you're meeting them? They're staying like that now?
Not here, but elsewhere we meet some people, those who are working especially.
Mm. We are forgetful enough just by accepting this body. And we've forgotten our spiritual identity. We don't need something to increase the forgetfulness. They're being honest. We work so hard, so much anxiety, we want to forget. Soon they'll be using the Western term, get wasted. I told you, I think before, how I was at speaking at the University of Manchester in UK. And there was a room full of students. And so, just to discuss with them and to understand their lifestyle more, I asked them some questions. So I said, what do you all do on a Friday night? Because after all, these were like students studying law, medicine, engineering, IT, the future hope of society. So what do you do on a Friday night? They looked at me like, what planet do you come from? What do we do on a Friday? We get wasted. I said, well, isn't it so that the next day you feel so bad and you feel so hungover, as they say? I said, that's true, but at least for a few hours on Friday night, we felt free from all our problems and happy. So even though we're miserable the next day, it's all worth it. These are future doctors, lawyers, engineers. They accept this cardinal principle as axiomatic truth, absolute truth. So much so they looked at me like I was crazy. How could you ask what do we do on a Friday? We are against this kind of society which forces people to work so hard, become so stressful that they have to turn to intoxication. We are against this kind of society. There's a lot of discussion now on what is morality, what are ethics, and psychological research has shown that what plays a major role in people's moral choices, not simply their independence and their free choice to be moral as they see it in this situation or that situation. No, most of morality is situational, that you take a so-called good person, put them in extraordinary circumstances, they'll do extraordinary things, extraordinary bad things. They get overwhelmed by their circumstances. We already know that. You are whom you associate with. If you associate with devotees, you'll do extraordinarily well. If you associate with materialists, you'll do extraordinarily abominable things just by being around them. The only way that people are going to have a chance amidst such a overpowering, overbearing materialistic society is if they get a chance to associate with devotees of the Lord, and those devotees are like ambrosia. They give the true relief. So you'll be hearing those kind of things more and more. What's wrong with taking the softer pleasure drugs? What's wrong with taking a little drink every night? It's called a nightcap. Help you to go to sleep at night. But people become alcoholics in that way, just taking one drink every night before going to sleep. After some years, you wind up unconsciously an alcoholic. So it's not a light, innocent thing. More and more, you're going to be feeling the effects of materialistic goals. Even here in Mumbai, you'll be more and more. That'll make it interesting for preaching because people will be forced to go one way or the other. Anything else? So if there's one thing that you remember from today's class, please remember that a materialistic, high-stress society can't go on without intoxication. Don't wonder about it. Secondly, no matter how much power and wealth you have, remember Hiranyakashipu. Unless you can control your senses, you won't be satisfied. By creating a culture of sense control in devotional service, best wealth is being generated for society. No state of mundane intoxication can match the pleasure of hearing of Lord Balaram's intoxication. His eyes rolling, wandering through the Vrindavan forest, demanding the Jamuna River come near. But his intoxicated state is purely spiritual. There's no material forgetfulness. There's no diminishment in bliss and knowledge. So if you're attracted to intoxication, try to understand Lord Balaram's intoxicated condition. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Glory to Srila Prabhupada.